three food companies, etc. After the season, they dispel the clothes that they were selling, and they don't use, they don't bring them back again. I don't think they do. Should that be considered as waste? The clothes that are not waste, then should such activities be regulated by the legislation?
Well, gee, I must say that the way I read the legislation now, the way it's drafted now, I would say that that would fall under the definition of waste, because it's discarded. Don't want it anymore. Therefore, in terms of the bill that you have, it is waste. Now, whether it's appropriate that it's waste is another matter, but if you certainly, if you're going to throw something, and especially at that scale, as you're talking about with an orange cup, you have to regulate. I think we would certainly say that it needs to be regulated.
Thank you. Any other questions? I'll tell you why, for me, I think it needs some regulation. We cannot have the situation in the context of the massive needs that we can throw things out. And I think this is a situation that will address that. It's not the situation. So I think that we must find a way in which, beyond the market, we might have a post-market solution. So I think the market does not have a use for it. It doesn't mean that human beings don't use everything for it. But we must find a way, and I think this legislation must talk about it. You can afford
it. See, if I could just say that it is important, I mean, I agree with you that it must be a thing, because we can't afford to throw things away that could be used to somebody else in our process. But I think that it would be important, and we would be very willing to engage with the department on that if you would want to do so. But the second-hand goods legislation, there may be some overlap here, for example, and also the import legislation. For example, and a lot of people overseas don't understand this, South Africa does not allow the importation of second-hand clothing. So in other words, precisely clothing which, say in England, they have no certain use for. They think, oh, let us send it to South Africa because there are poor people that can use it. That is forbidden under our International Trade Administration Act because of the risk that it undermines our own clothing industry. But, and it was dealt with also in the second-hand goods bill in the same way, and the trade unions are very strong on that. But maybe there's a case to be made for a slightly more subtle approach to the matter. And I think one needs to look how these different pieces of legislation perhaps could work together, still to regulate in a way that doesn't undermine our industrial base, but at the same time allow something that really shouldn't be thrown away because it has some use, could still be used. I think there's some work to be done there. Thank you very much. We now invite Mr. Lulia. In my list,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jan Bidders. I'm from Pretoria. and I represent myself, my property in view of store enforcement cement, and also on the same height as the highest of the chimney. And then secondly, as chairman of the Westwood Residence Association, and fourthly, as chairman of four of the service portfolios on Ward 1. Mr. Chairman, just for a very moment, and on a very light note, I was born in Ekalahari, I was brought up there, and we had Afrikaans for the first language, second language is Afrikaans, third language Afrikaans. So if I tell you today that there are seven cows in the field, or there is seven cows in the field, please just tell where the cows are and how many there are. And then we have a saying in Pretoria that we have a VBE, that's a very bad English. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and honourable members of the committee for the moment to address you. The cement industry wants to incinerate in their kiln as a secondary alternative fuel. It will have a saving for the cement industry, but we're absolutely positive that it will have a negative impact on the health of the community, and I'll just explain in a few months for which Barview community is. And the cement industry will also be profitable because they'll be paid to incinerate these tires, which is one of the stuff they intend to use in their kilns. Now, Rakilis area, Rakilis is a communal name or a name for the whole area. Comprises of nine suburbs, and then we also have what we call a mud area. Now, mud area, if we tell these to the Cape people, they laugh at us. On the northern side, the Magaliesberg, which they say is not a berg, and on the southern side, it's Witwatersberg, and that's also just a hilltop. But that's what's called. And between these two mountains, the area stretches right from Mamelodi, which is very far away, right down to the Arkutel Dam. Something like a 35 kilometers is so little. So it's a huge area, and the second thing that that was also that during all these, or some of these investigations, they found that the area where the store enforcement cement factory is situated at the moment is the area that has the least wind in the whole of South Africa. So everything that goes up just has to come down. Or they've blown in this wood area down to the the area. Now, the history of the cement factory is established in 1800. Now, in the late 1800s. Now, during that time, it was out of town. But with the expansion, it's now in the center of a huge area. We have something like three or four areas to our north, further away from town. The cement dust was always a problem. Right from the beginning, I came there in 1961, and from that time, it was already a problem. There's very little feedback from the PBC and also from the municipality when we report these excessive cement dust emissions. And that's why we have in our main topic, we don't trust them. Because they promise us a lot of things, but they do very, very little. And sometimes it goes for years and years without any feedback on what we're reporting. We really call it, and we want to emphasize that there's a silence in the past and there's a silence now in our report. Now, during the time there were some scrapping reports. There was a vascular flora survey, and I quote from it, and it says during December 23, 2005, a layer of hardened cement dust, not evident behind the long grass, which is not really important, and obviously deposited over a period of time, occurred on the rocks and in undisturbed areas. between the plant and the ground over the entire site. This might account for the low number of plant species that were recorded on the site. Now what happens is that these two mountains, the Baha'i Dust is separated between east and west by the vulnerable poor cutting. And the artificy, and also the artificy, and the artificy cuts the red water back also into between the eastern and the western side. Now on the eastern side there seems to be a really not in abundance but quite a lot of plants which is extinct. Now it comes to two of these extinct, some of them, others on the restless data for the southern side. And these two are the yellow pellegrine, and that's it on the red data list. And the Holotrix randi. Now the orchard, some of the botanists told us that it might be that they need excessive rain or even fires to reactivate again. And we've had a concerted effort with the residents association people and through all these gifted towns, and we couldn't find a single one of them. So they really seem to be extinct. I can attribute local decisions there, and they attribute the high incidence of lung problems, lung problems, sinus, asthmatic, to the deposit, high deposit of cement dust in the area. We also have a very alarming, high rate of level of skin in the school, something like a 30%, they told us. Skin conditions, that's very, very, very prominent. Ajit Kumani Community Clinic in 2006 saw 55,000 patients for the year, double that of any clinic in the Pretoria area. And we have no scientific proof of it, but everybody claims it is just that is causing that. Cars are provided with cement dust, or not provided, covered with cement dust, and they regularly have to wash it, otherwise they stick to the cars. A lot of roofs in that Tory area, Tory Garden area, or the wood area, started rusting, and we attribute it to either acid or alkaline deposit onto the roofs from the cement dust. Now, something else we experience that a lot of people in these areas, especially now where it seems to have an increase of dust coming from these buildings, that people are taking out their carpets and they're replacing it with all sorts of materials, but not carpets, because you can't get it. The moment you start cleaning it, it turns into a sort of cement type of solidness. You can't get it in. These increased emissions, now we also have a report drawn up by Victoria Portland Cement themselves, by one of their consultants. And these people have very alarming reports for us. There was a march in our mental service of reference, which we have the number. And they say that, and I quote from these, no empirical models exist to predict reliably the exact effect of waste streams on emissions from a kiln. And that troubles it. I'll come back to this one just for a moment. And they say for the NOx and dust, current emissions will be there too. That the current emissions will go out. Now, and then they admit the emissions leaving the process are the largest potential source of environmental impact from the process, and the emissions that are of the significance are nitrogen oxide, sulfur oxide, and dust. Other important emissions include carbon dioxide, volatile organic compounds, dioxin, furans, and metals. So you can see there is quite a lot of stuff that's coming not only visible. Which we have something like a PM10, which these reports are based on, and is now internationally is down to 2.5. And the effects of these are the community health effects, respiratory impact, and possible toxic substances producing cancers from these dumps. CO2, VOCs, dioxins, and furans. Now, I hope we have people that are more medically inclined than me to separate these from the other ones. Now, they also say that with the burning of the intended burning of these new fuels, we'll have a volatile and semi-volatile metals, mercury, thallium, and cadmium, and also chromium, without all the explanations for it. And they claim that there should be and will be an increase from the report by themselves. There will be an increase in the deposit of these metals. At this stage, there is uncertainty of what the emissions will actually consist of. In other words, there will be no use for it if the government or whatever says, or the health department, to say that we will restrict these, because they don't know. As our point out, they say they don't have fast productions where they can say this is what the emissions were or were. So there's nothing at that stage where they can say, if we start burning tires, this will be the emissions and this is what we have to look out for. Please keep that in mind. Toxic metals will not be captured. As I mentioned, we're down, at the moment it's 10 PM and the international is down to 2.5. Right. Cement quality will be affected by the extra or less materials going into the cement. Potential community health ethics, which I've already pointed out. Present emissions are unacceptably high, and that was during one of these presentations. It was admitted by Mr. Bryce, who conducted the report, that they are unacceptably high, the present emissions. And then also, Mr. Chairman, they use slurry. Now, slurry, if I'm correct, is somewhere in the Northern Cape. I think it's an uninhabited area, and they use that to see what the impact on the Pretoria is. But Pretoria, that's a specific area. It's something like 55,000 people we have in that area. So you can't combine these or the one is predicting the other one. And I'm just afraid that some of these reporters or the cement industry by themselves are trying to hide some very, very dangerous information from us by trying to get us off the rail. They have in their own report 15 to 14 times higher levels of dioxin than is allowable. Current levels high of NOx emissions, some of them as high as 118.75% more than the limit for it. We had no response on all our requests from PPC, no response from the health institutions. We report them, but absolutely nothing comes from it. So how can we trust these people if something should come up with its new fuels, or proposed new fuels? How can we trust these people to really come back to us if there's a bigger problem than we have at the moment? That's why I started off by saying we can't trust them. Burning waste fuel will only benefit the cement industry and will not benefit the community. In fact, it will rather be detrimental to us. Members and Mr. Chairman, please. I refer you also to item 26.1b of the law, and that says, dispose, no person may dispose of waste in a manner that is likely to cause pollution of the environment or harm to health and well-being. And I appeal to you, honorable leaders and Mr. Gentlemen, to assist us not to allow the cement factories to burn secondary materials. Our biggest asset in this country is nothing. It's not gold, it's not copper, it's not gold, it's our people. And we should not allow the clean environment to deteriorate to a stage where we are ashamed to say, I am proud to be a South African. Mr. Gentleman, I'll leave my numbers on the screen, please. Please, if somebody wants to come and contact us to come and see what is the truth and what is not the truth, please, there they are. We would love to be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. On the ground presentation. We move on to Mr. Singer.
I'm a member of the work community. I live in the community for the time. My uncle's house was my uncle's house is not open to the plan. I've got two children and I was born in the area. One student say our roads are after terrified for our children and it turned green. We cannot open the doors to leave because of the damage. Our houses are turning black inside. Our neighborhood has been higher rate of TB in other historical areas. In 1994, the World Trade Forum tried to arrange a meeting with TPC mentioning our problem. But they have not returned to us with meaningful solutions. People's homes are on the same line. Of the image, not across the road. What do we want from TPC? We do not want them to end with. They have never answered us on our presentation. And now they want to create new problems. How can we trust them now? We want independent chemical research. The politicizing process was not developed in any manner that we for community inputs and competing at the time. We want other own qualities of participation such as issues in the community, in the community. Government is not acting to protect us. Then you want to say, if you want to say, come to your honorable chairman to see that this thing is true, the conduct line is the number for the issue.
We have you, Honorable
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I come from KwaZulu-Natal, on the border of the district. It's an area called Angulkulwane, also known as Nangalbarele. I bought a farm there in 1989. At that time, the farm was already, the farmers had lived there for over 100 years, and there was a community, a Bengali community, and we built a temple there. Most of the people there are Hindus, and the temple is still running up to here. In 1980, the factory was opened at NPC, which is at present owned by an EU country that is Portugal. And it was opened by the then Minister of Interior, who later became the last state president of the Portugal. is the Honorable FWD and you can see on the candidate in 1980. 4 years later, the school which is on the boundary of this factory closed because of noise pollution and fallout from the factory. Now, this is a very old Indian community, or they would say in those days, a non-white community, because, and it didn't live there for over 100 years. Today, there are only 5 Indian families left. And there are farmers who are still running their farms, but the laborers' children now, they haven't got a school to go. They are the school still existed. The school was closed in 1984 by the same House of Delegates. And those children wake up at about 4 in the morning, walk about 10 kilometers, come back at 4 in the afternoon, and you see them on the road. The traffic is calm, they ask for water. As I said, that place is called Langa, but there is very, very much. You don't understand the thing. It's very, very hot. And they still stop at the person of the and ask for water, and they wake up 4 in the morning, and the parents fall out. Had the school, and they promised us the school at that time, it had never been built. Had the school couldn't be this day, those children would be walking only about 2 kilometers. Then, also with the advent of this factory, they built a road that catered for not heavy volumes of traffic. Now, since 2 years ago when South Africa was awarded the 2010 World Cup, Soccer World Cup, they are producing cement there now, and before they only provide crushed cement and take it to Devon and bag it there. Now they are bagging cement in the area. So the pollution is at a greater level. In 1992, they had two EIAs. In 1992, they had Mr. Mark Wood from Johannesburg, who did a survey. And when we spoke to him, he said that we said, I cannot give you the report, I must give it to them. We've asked the NCC for the report, and up till now, 15 years ago, we haven't seen the report. What are they hiding from us? In other words, there was a comment made by two Mr. Woods at that time. It seems that he who pays the price was caused the shooting. Until now we haven't seen that report. And today that because of the new factory was back cement, the traffic is heavy. I heard on Sunday the traffic go up and down and they are foreigners to the truck. I think most of them are with the traffic legislature or whatever it is. A little girl about 15 or 16, she hitched the lip it happened about 2 weeks ago. So the traffic is heavy, and besides down there, I caught it at 17 there, and that's a very, very, very peaceful community. But from the factory, as the developer said earlier, they do not tell us what it is from the factory. Nothing. We've asked them time and time again, we've got no reply. And they do this on a Sunday morning and in the evening. I won't say every evening, but most days of the week. My daughter was a technologist. We live in an area where there is no water, so we have tanks, water tanks. The water that falls on the roof is put into the tank. And with this emission, we are concerned about the health of the people in the area. I haven't done any research, but we know people who are suffering from health, breathing problems, lung cancer. cancer, and recently, my daughter is about 25 years old. She left home because she said, Daddy, I can't stay here. My hands are stretching. Because she has to watch this. She cannot stay there, so she moved to put her to, and there's no such thing. Now, it affects the crop. That area was noted for its subtropical fruit. That is, pawpaws, mangoes, bananas, and tamarind. There was, in the 1950s, I don't know, there was a book called Man's Environment, which we used for the study of geography. There was a picture of a girl cutting pawpaws. Go to the area today and see how much pawpaws are left there. Hardly any. The pawpaws have disappeared from the place. It has affected our crops. And the most important thing, when we tell them that it's affecting our crops, they brought a guy, they brought a professor, Professor Allen from at that time, the University of Natal, in Manchester, and he planted a pawpaw seed just about 200 meters from the factory, in their property. And then they showed us the pawpaws were growing. But my point is, if you take a flat stone and throw it into a placid pool of water, concentric circles form. So the, in other words, as the air is coming out, we further and further. And they do not want to talk about what is coming out emitted from the sack, obviously. And this has been an ongoing problem with our people as well, results of what's coming out. And it is. Now, the school that I didn't mention, the school was closed in 1984 by the general delegates because they wanted to build it. The school, they built a new baggage plant next. And that, last year when you spoke to them, I mentioned to them, when you buy the property, school property, be proactive in your thinking, and then you can pay out the community. At that point, they say they have nothing to do with the school. We won't talk to the community about buying the school. Now they are begging us for the school. A very big property, which is about 2 years, it's about 2 years there. They are begging us, and we are just in your defense, I'm really in your you come to us, we discuss. Right. Now, my point is to tell the committee here that we don't want them to be tired to learn the daily, as this we are coming. They must prove to us what is the emission from this effect. There must be a fundamental way, there must be transparency between the community and the fact, yeah? Because it seems that somebody lying, someone along the line. Any race should not be intimidated, and that must be, as it is, they are banning cement, they've already started using. Using materials to burn it. I don't know if they got permission from the state yet. But they are burning it at the very point in time. I would like to suggest to the portfolio committee, pay us a visit at any time possible and see for yourselves. And see for yourselves how. And the area has been destroyed. It is one of the most beautiful valleys in Potsdamer County. It is one of the most beautiful, I will say that again. It is one of the most beautiful areas in Potsdamer County. But look at the tree. There's hardly any crops. And now they want to introduce some animals. They've already introduced the zebra on their property. And they've got the ostriches actually. I ask the committee to visit us and check for yourself. There's my name, there's my number. You can contact me at any time because I'm retired. Thank you.
Yes, sir. I think let's invite all the other presidents that are associated to recommend the committee to call you. We now invite Onika to follow.
Thank you for one of the questions. My name
thank you all our chapters and Maria is going to Kalipuru and what councillor in the Togota local municipality as a Lakamutur Murema district in Northwest. Just an omission there, I have been a councillor for the past 10 years as a ward councillor. That is why our community has a trust on me and they voted for me again to be a councillor. Honorable Chairperson, I am here representing the community and also municipality. The history that I'm going to share with the house here is that in the Northwest government, there is a company called Holcim, and then this Holcim has been appointed some consultants to go around to engage some departments, government departments, including the farmers, and the community situated along the plant to work meeting with them so that government can allow them to build a cleaner form. But as we know that Holcim plant in Alco, in Baku West, at Northern Cape was granted permission with some type of study, like Luxembourg. But the problem that we have been encountered is that we've got an illegal landfill site just situated 2 kilometers along from our community. And we cannot deny that we have challenges as a municipality in all our municipalities around South Africa that are women and children. And as councillors, we have this problem of children dropping at school, follow their parents to go to the dumping site or to the landfill, because we know that poverty is all around, and these children leave the school to go there, maybe to go and collect some medals and something so that they can get a living. And in that area, we have a farmer that always coming to municipality to complain about the water contaminated at the boreholes, because they are also situated at Holcim cement. And also that we know that these farmers are using the dam, they open them, and their livestock are drinking water there. Their water is becoming contaminated by plant activities and this dust from Holcim cement. We are not agreeing as a community from Luxembourg that Holcim want to ban waste in cement killing so that they can also using it. Because previously or in the three plants that have already there, they've been using the fuel that like coal to burn the cement. But now they want to change to burn the waste so that people can go as a landfill to go there and collect some plastic, to go and collect some waste and bring it to that person so that they can bring it to their settlement. But we are not agreeing with Holcim. We want the government not to give them permission so that we are against of bringing the waste. I've got a recommendation, Honorable Chairperson, saying that as we know that at municipalities at large, we have been governed by the law of Municipal Services Act, and also in we have been governed by bylaws, and then we think or we like that
the law can be strictly on our municipalities, that we know that there is no rent and our people are unemployed. We think that we want that this bylaw to be strictly that our municipalities can hire people, and give them the protective clothes and pay them the basic salaries to do this waste, to separate this waste and hotels and to leave the process. Because our people or our community are doing an illegal training. But if our municipality can hire them and give them the basic salary, it will be better. Our people will have to live. And the other thing is that the cement that is worked in cement plant should be used the best technology that is available in the market. Because we are facing with the dust that our water sources at this plant. And we want this a regular community monitoring of the plant because as my recommendation, we want the regular community monitoring of the plant. That the community must be monitored so that a Shepperton, this wholesome cement should not use the illegal waste that they are intending to do. And lastly, my telephone numbers are there, and even my cell number as a counselor. I wish the portfolio committee can visit our area to come and see what is happening in our area. I'd like to thank you.
I'm drinking energy now from the Nadi PPC. From Nadi Portland Cement. I'm representing the community of Matatin. Matatin is built of a plant roof with a plastic where our people live in. Our people are not working. The PPC is hiring people outside our community. People are struggling when they walk about 15 to 16 kilometers to go to the doctor to the clinic. They don't have nothing because the PPC doesn't hire them. They hire people outside our community, outside the class. So, our people are living, they don't have nothing for living. They get the food parcels from the government, but even though the food parcels come after 5 to 6 months, at least they cope on it. They cope on it. coming out for municipality or for another thing in PPC, it's about 500 kilometers to 800 kilometers away from the plant. The community has been waiting for the LDP houses for a long time. And they have no basic water. They are using bushes for when you want to go to the toilet. And some of our people are struggling due to the sickness that tuberculosis, the problem of ISO, and due to this immense infection. Other thing, the people are striking for tuberculosis. Even when the small kids are treated for TB, the kids like 4 months to 6 months kids, they are treated for TB tuberculosis. please, I need our government to help us. But not to allow the PPC to then waste, because this waste is going to cause us a lot of trouble. It only causes us trouble because even small kids are treated for TB. So it means we are all going to die, because presently people are dying every week. People are dying of tuberculosis. We bury for 2-3 every week because of this disease. So if they are going to be entire and waste, I think we are all going to die. So we are going to suffer from this sickness of these things which are going to be tired for them. Even though we are trying to put the water in a bucket, you can see the cement is just underneath the bucket. So we are drinking the cement. That's why maybe a lot of people are actually dying every day. Please, I need government to help us not to get them tired, because it's going to cause us problems. When the wave is raining, I think the wave is the wind. The rain is going to the air to go down, to drop down, just going to spoil the soil. So we are not going to have nothing. Even the Africans, those who are doing agriculture, they are not going to benefit nothing from the soil. Because it's going to kill everything. Please, I want the government to help us. To let the PPC to spend with, because our people will die and suffer. I'm seeing the university. My number is
members. I would also just like to point to two publications.
which we have done on cement kilns, and on waste paper cement kilns, which you can use in thinking around responding to the law.
Could we then invite comments with Dr. Chandler?
Looking at some of that in relation to it, and there has been a parallel process, we've had some international expertise afforded to us through our Zanita program in order to get people into to look at the international experience of burning waste in cement kilns and where it can and can't be done and under what circumstances and what kind of kilns and what are the side, what are the health effects and what are the general environmental effects. So that piece of work is ongoing. And what we will be doing probably in the first quarter of next year is taking the work that has been done so far and consulting on it. So I mean, I think the issue of cement kilns and the burning of waste is one issue, but I think that there's clearly a major problem with the environmental management of certainly in relation to kind of, I think, the three or four PPC plants that have been talked about, and I think that we should do that. The other thing is that in the same way as we've systematically gone out and done a major enforcement initiative with the ferroalloy industry over the last year, we said we would start with the ferroalloy industry and then we would move on to other sectors. And maybe in our own planning, what we should be saying is that we should be doing compliance inspections in the cement industry in the same way as we've done with metal and house and steel and van chem and all of those other major industries. I think the reality is that in part it's to a large extent this is an enforcement thing, and it's only now that the capacity is starting to exist in government to systematically enforce law. But I think there are things in the waste law that will make it much easier for us to ensure that a whole lot of these problems in fact don't happen and that the tools and the mechanisms are put in place to ensure that you can start to control it better. Yeah, I mean, I think there are vacuums at the moment that make it very hard to enforce.
Create a legislative environment where it will be more manageable, but in the meantime, there are a whole range of scenarios happening out there where people's health and their livelihoods and their lives are being affected. So I do think sometimes it needs some sort of fairly strong oversight from such as ourselves to just say to those industries and PPC in particular, look, we're looking at you, we're watching, we're seeing, and we are, and to produce a parliamentary report on what our findings are. Mm-hmm. And that might, they might start then not burning waste, but going the route of less sort of health damaging and environmentally unfriendly ways of managing their cement kilns.
What I could not get clearly, and maybe the one can respond to you, is what is the concern of the community? Is it what in the gap that comes from this, which I would think is probably also a matter of the air quality. Can be useful there. Whether it is the best incineration, but the concerns about incineration and what it could have in the air, or issues such as the toxic water, which could be a reference for the state as a result of waste. So what exactly, what are the key concerns that the communities are raising? But those concerns are, one, with regard to the deal that we're working on, and broadly, maybe there are other concerns that need other legislation or express an inadequate of other legislation.
Yeah, I think
firstly, it is interesting that you made that link between the Air Quality Bill, the Air Quality Act, and the waste bill that is now in place. And what we are trying to do is to make sure that all our bills that we have talk together and work together. The thing why we're bringing it up here is that hazardous waste, sewage pellets, wood, volatile organic compounds such as possibly the waste from Sasol and ISCO, all their carpets, all that hazardous waste that is now classified as hazardous waste, is going to be possibly burnt in those cement kilns if they give us permission to burn waste. So the issue is waste. Burning that waste, incinerating that waste, and that's why we bring it here. But what we bring up here as a collective as well is that we are saying, how can we trust these industries doing such a critical and dangerous thing when presently they're not governed, they only govern honorable chairperson for dust. And some of those incinerators are already burning hazardous waste, like in New Brighton. They're burning hazardous waste from pollutants, BHP pollutants in Richards Bay. But these incinerators, and we've got, we have to go through the through a legal Public Access Information Act process to get the permits from the department to be able to see what was going on, and those permits are not worth the paper they're written on. And I'm very happy, and we will support the DDG in making sure that we work with the in tightening up those permits for the industry. But what we're saying is that there are present problems around dust, people health, and all of that that has been there for more than 50, 60 years in some cases. These guys are not helping us to understand their processes, and now they want us to believe that they will burn hazardous waste safely, and I will talk more about that later.
I'd like to welcome the honorable members. I apologize for the statement. Can you invite again? I'd like to thank you for coming through and sharing. One of the things we will look at, and indeed we will undertake specific initiatives, certainly next year, around the cement industry. We think that the real problem, what Mashaman is raising, is important. We should indeed have a program of cement and so on. That is all the area. So we might be still part of us in your area.
The decision of Akin White, Mr. Desmond Kisa, is here. And good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, Honourable Chair. Good afternoon, Honourable Members of Parliament, ladies and gentlemen. Being the Honourable Members of Commission, or the Commission. I thought I was going to talk a little, but I'll stick with English for a while. I'm coming from South Durban, and I'm lucky that I'm here, because I spent the whole of Monday night at the Indian Refinery, as sure as you heard on the news. And still burning as I talk to you now. 3 days. It's an example of bad where the corporations are not affecting the changes, even though we have the new Air Quality Act, there's no enforcement. And I want to say that the green scorpions, when they cross the Maluti Mountains or the Drakensberg and come to KwaZulu-Natal, they become the comedians. So that tells you a lot. My presentation to the Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Parliament. Firstly, I want to say thank you for allowing me the time to come to Cape Town and to interact with you and present our concerns around this waste problem. So our remarks is coming from the Constitution, Section 24A, our right to a clean and healthy environment, and we find that today, 13 years after democracy, environmental racism is still alive. That's very crucial. And I think one finds that the hazardous waste that has been dumped for many years in Umlazi is still a serious concern, in particular in black neighborhoods. South Durban, as you know, stems from the tip of the Durban Harbor, where we had the fire on the 18th of December at the LNG complex, where 10 tanks were exploded and caught on fire. Right down to Umkamas to Sapi Cycle, where there are landfill sites dumped illegally by the company, but also surrounding the Sapi Cycle plant is black communities who are suffering the impacts and effects of the paper company. So, in South Durban, there are five hazardous dump sites, particularly Umlazi, where WasteTech and some of those major companies like WasteTech, Waste Services, that are operating. And I can tell you now the jobs are very limited. And you know of the illegal dump that's been taking place in the Nearbank, South Durban area, where Bayer has been dumping chrome for many years, and only in 2004 did we uncover it. And you know that our homes were the storage tanks, for the chrome 6. And chrome 6, which you know, we saw the film, Darren Brockovich. Darren Brockovich, you would realize the danger that chrome 6 presents and the cancer associated with that chemical. And as I talk to you, they're still trying to recover the chrome on the people's homes. It might take 10 years, it might take 50 years. No one really is sure. And I think the ratepayers and the citizens of this country is paying for profit makers. And I think that's crucial to understand that point. At the end of the day, that the people are paying the price for huge profit makers that doesn't benefit the society. The other very crucial important point here is that hazardous waste is transported through the community to the landfill sites in Umlazi or Bulbul in Chatsworth or in Kennedy Road and, cause a problem. I must say that I listened very carefully to what Standard Bank and the banking sector were concerned about the contaminated land. And I think we welcome the focus on the contaminated land. We support the department wholeheartedly. Irrespective of what the banks have said here today, we think the banks must be held accountable as well. They've made huge profits, and even they were selling these lands, and they knew what they were doing. So we are quite pleased with this move. We need to deal with the historical legacy of dumps in poor black communities, and I alluded to that initially in my opening statement that the legacy of environmental racism. You know, the sad part is Umlazi was supposed to cover up while the then minister of the Department of Water and Forestry had come down and said in 1997, Umlazi is closed. The sad part is the waste company dug up three roads bigger than this building, and one of the Anglo-Americans started to dump their coal ash. After we had pressurized them in 95, in the Nearbank community to close down the toxic coal ash dump site. And after we had to prove as a community that the ash contained heavy metals like mercury and cyanide, we had to get experts to do that there by the University of, which is now known as the Durban University of Technology. At that time it was called the Emerald Frontown Technicon. We have shown that the companies, we want to make sure that the companies will pay the true cost for polluting our land. And they've got away with it in the past. You know, in 2001, we had the Shell and BP refinery, a big pipeline leak, and under the Bluff community, we had millions of liters of petrol that leaked under people's homes, and it's still there. Up until today, it's still there. It might take hundreds of years to remove. So who is responsible for that? Will the local government, will the state be responsible? Why not those companies that have made huge profits be held responsible for the action? And this is what we've been calling for. The Monty paper mill in South Durban, and this is the Monty paper dump site, the coal ash. You see the huge heaps of coal that were dumped in the neighborhood. This used to be prime farmland. Next to it is prime farmland as well. And they just started dumping illegally. This is the ash from incineration, as you see. And that ash, even as it's incinerated, It also contains heavy metals and has to be dumped in some landfill. So at the end of the day, incineration doesn't work. This is the mountain that is claimed to be in the Malawi in key sections. It never used to be a mountain, it's been level as the road, and then built those huge mountains with all the toxic ash out of Mondi. Yeah, we see again over another side of it as well. And this is going right next to it. It's like walk out of your house. And you must know those are substandard houses in Malawi. Very poor people, a lot of unemployment, running, the children are affected with running noses, the chests are sore, half the time they go to school, they are sent home because they're sick, they can't unable to enjoy quality education because the schools are affected as well with their schools. So the waste companies are making huge profits, and the companies that are dumping the waste are in South Durban. The biggest companies are the refineries, as well as the paper malls and other companies. This is where we are on the dump site, and you can see how much of land of the landfill site has been taken. And Malawi has got about, at least, we're looking at about 300,000 to 400,000 people living there. And it's quite a huge population. Now, why must the population suffer from people that make profit and don't live in those communities? Why must the dump sites continuously be placed in black communities? This is a question I want to ask you as members of the Portfolio Committee and the chair of the Portfolio Committee. How can we continue to allow this here, because our people are paying the price, to continue in this day and age with these huge multinational corporations who have the best technology, would not be able to allow to operate the way they are operating in South Africa, would operate in Europe. They would be held accountable, they would be prosecuted and brought before a court of law. And we're saying to you today, you have the opportunity, you are the people that you are the custodians of the people of this country. We need you to help us to make sure that the legislation is dropped in the interest of people. People must come first. Mustn't be money. This is the Island View storage tank that exploded the other day, and that waste, there are tons of waste. We also found a dangerous chemical, bromomethylene. And according to the health information from the researchers, they said it was 64 times found anywhere else in the world. These are the storage tanks at Island View that collapsed, and all that was dumped. In fact, some of the chemicals they released into the Durban Valley. They found hundreds of species of marine life that were killed off. Contaminated lands must remain in the film. All the hazardous landfill sites in communities must be closed, taking the precautionary principles into effect. We can't continue to allow this here. There are people who are majority suffering, the unemployed, the poor, the suffering. There should be strong legislation on the transfer of hazardous waste to communities. Research into the effect of hazardous waste dumping on communities must be considered in the vote. We believe certainly just before I close on the issue of youth visitors, I want to say that 2 weeks ago I was in Richards Bay, and I must say I visited Felixton, the sugar mill. I also visited the paper mill in Mondi, and they each have an illegal dump. There's a perception that is created that people, communities are illegally dumping the garbage. Let me tell you, you see first world multinational corporations that dump illegally on land, and if you go to Richards Bay and other communities in South Africa, the same old story that these companies, there's relentless lawlessness among these companies, the CEOs, they just allow their management structure to dump all over on community land and on prime agricultural land, which is threatening food security, threatening the water resources of this country, and presently we've had huge problems in the past in Richards Bay and KwaZulu-Natal on water shortages. This will impact much more, and therefore we'd like to see that this portfolio committee, in fact, visited all these hotspots, visited the area before this bill is actually passed. We think that the bill certainly falls far short of effect to the Section 24, our right to a clean and healthy environment. I certainly believe that coming out of South Durban, working over many years with poor black communities, suffering the impact of pollution and health impacts, we have got health studies. The health study in 2006, in July 2006, was very clear. It showed that the correlation between the communities of South Durban, that there's been an increase in cancer by 25%. It showed that the asthma rate is rising. It showed that other mental deficiencies and other illnesses are starting to rise in the local communities. Surely there, that in itself must inform this weight loss. That is not the case, even though in the preamble they talk about health and so on. But the bill is very discretionary. It doesn't place a responsibility on government to challenge the industry to clean up their mess. It doesn't place a responsibility on department officials to make sure that they hold the polluting and the waste companies accountable for their actions. And I think this is where the bill falls far short of ensuring that we live to a healthy and clean environment that allows our children to study and to educate themselves and enjoy the quality education that is given to other people, children, in particular the CEOs and managers of these companies. Their children enjoy quality education. Our kids also deserve to enjoy quality education, and their whole life is being impacted upon. So I therefore invite you to call me if you want to arrange a meeting. You are arranging the ranger tour to come there. We'll take you to Malawi, we'll take you to Mondi, we'll take you to the Chrome downside, and we'll show you firsthand of what is going on. As I'm sitting here, people are calling me because their children have been affected in South Durban already. Lots of people are running to the clinics and the hospitals, and the industry is just saying it down, don't worry, everything will be okay. But we are saying that the onus is on government to take action. I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and Honorable Members of the Committee. My name is Mabule Zimuchine. I'm with Shukas. I work within our People's Empowerment Center in Juliet Park, which is a project that was set up in response to the need to promote sustainable living and bringing the people. As well as the French coordinator of FLIFE, Africa, joining the French. I think it's also important for me to mention just by the way, that in hindsight that I'm also studying part-time with UNISA, which is found relevant to the introduction, but I hope to glue the bits together in the presentation. I'm doing financial mathematical modeling, and the reason why I'm doing that is because I'm constantly being bombarded with I'm reasoning that sustainable development or sustainable development initiatives are not economically viable. So that has actually become a challenge for me to, you know, explore how mathematical applications can be adapted to sustainable living initiatives. Thank you. First, zero waste is not the target, and I think it's very important that I mentioned that from the onset. But then what is it? Zero waste is a process, the goal of which is to prevent waste generation and production, which is upstream, and right throughout the supply chain to the end user, that is downstream. It is to recreate a society like they used to be 20 to 30 years ago, a society free from high volumes of waste generation and adverse impacts of exposure to toxic synthetic chemicals. It is to restore the sustainable use of limited natural resources, thereby bringing the balance between resource availability and use into the future. It is to reduce waste generation by redesigning production processes and products to those that are usable, recyclable, and or compostable. If we can rewind to 20 to 30 years back, and appreciate that people, whenever they were going to shop, they took either a bag or a basket to shop. The paper and not disposable plastic was the ready application material. but waste generation and later on the scale now generated was unthought of. Repair, reuse, and composting were normal practices in communities. And why I mention this? It's simply to dispel the myth that zero waste is impossible. Waste as we know it in modern society is a creation of, you know, the way we live, and it's not very long that we've come to this type of a wasteful society. So we can go back 30, 20 years, 50 years back, 50 years of telling. Regarding the upcoming provisions of the bill, the current challenge of waste in SA is also an opportunity to create a clean, safe, and healthy environment, providing the bill enforces the phasing in of life cycle assessment of products, clean production processes, full cost accounting, producer responsibility, and producer system. And I want to speak a little bit about some of these things. First of all, it would not be easy for companies to take responsibility for the products that they produce if they are not incorporating full cost accounting. And I'll catch on to that later on. Secondly, there's also a challenge to producer responsibility. And this is the slide before this one. When I was growing up, and I guess most of the people in this room, when we went to buy milk, we took a bottle with us. And on that bottle, there was a provision that the bottle remains the property of the company. When you went and bought soft drinks, there was a provision for the container that it remains the property of the company. Now, all that in 11 and 10 years of my growing up, it's fast been eroded off and replaced by disposable container and disposable. In addition, the bill also needs to support the decentralization of waste management services to communities. It should support partnerships. It should support partnerships. It needs to support partnerships between community-oriented initiatives and contractors waste management service providers, where they like us, and should provide administrative support, continue to provide recycling facilities in place of waste management and disposal facilities only, and oversight of facilities and operations. It should also compel producers to display the accessibility and or compatibility of the package or container. It should support related application and consumer awareness. And specifically, it should allude to the 2001 Food Quality Declaration to reduce waste generation by 25% and disposal by 50% while developing a zero waste plan by 2022. Downstream, without the provisions above, SA will miss the opportunity to phase in for separation to reduce waste generation. To reduce the rate of loss of limited resources to waste, to reduce the further contamination of land and pollution of air and water, to grow local reuse, recycling, and composting measures, to clean the 2020 Soccer World Cup as a running point for waste reduction, to create jobs and reduce the ecological footprint resulting from our throwaway and current consumerist culture. And what are the costs? In 2002, SA was noted to be generating between 532 and 566 million tons of waste. This was taken from the draft IWMS Integrated Waste Management Strategy of the City of Johannesburg. And waste disposal cost 85 rand per ton, and this was taken from one of the waste management service providers within the City of Johannesburg. So my point about doing studying the meter, if you do your calculations, then you have the amount of money that is lost from the economy rather than could be put in sustainable livelihoods. Data cost the city of Johannesburg 25 million in the year 2002. And in addition, data has led to the pollution and loss of aquatic life in major rivers in and around Johannesburg from runoff during rainfall. Who pays for these costs? The government and the public. The public pays tax, service charges for waste collection, health costs when they are sick, and invariably from some of the exposure to the adverse impacts in the environment. And also, seriously, the loss of livelihoods, and this has been related by a number of previous speakers. On the other hand, the government subsidizes health costs through building clinics, providing, you know, primary health care. They also subsidize remediation. Pro Chemical is village in the area of Natal. It's a case in point, and there are others. And pay social grants, especially for people who end up chronically ill, not necessarily, you know, who come chronically ill from some of the environmental impacts. In my conclusion, I would like to reflect on the following: that landfilling leads to loss of limited natural and financial resources and the contamination of potential sands. So it's not only the resources that we're losing, but we're also contaminating the land that we throw those resources to. So it's a double loss. Incineration, on the other hand, may be transformed solid materials into gases and particulates, and dump these in the atmosphere and in the animal and plant tissue where it accumulates. With our constitution registered to be the best, SA needs this bill to enforce constitutional provisions for a safe, clean, and healthy environment. And before I thank you, I'd like to quote from the recent Mail and Guardian edition. And it reads, "Is it true that our environment agenda is a luxury of the rich and an inconvenience to the poor? That the poor cannot afford it? At the dawn of democracy in 1994, the ANC issued a statement in which it said, environmental issues must be spread beyond wildlife management and include the townships and rural areas." Close quote. 13 years on, has the country in general, and the ANC in particular, translated this into practice? On that note, I'd like to thank you.
Identify some of the zero waste gaps and the opportunities missed in the pool. I'm from the Gaia Cooperative, I'm an industrial engineer, and the Gaia Cooperative promotes the adoption of a full cost accounted economy. Full cost accounted products are those that have the ecological, social, and economic health costs disclosed, as well as the financial costs. So you can get an understanding of your ecological and social footprint when you buy a product. I don't know if you can hear me. Can anyone hear me?
Yeah.
This goal can really only be achieved if of a full cost accounted economy, if we use life cycle assessment to basically track the impact of that product over the whole life cycle, from extraction of the material used to make that product all the way through to its disposal or reuse. That's normally termed as cradle to grave. There's been a lot of talk about life cycle assessments. I just wanted to outline that for some of the members, other members who may not have come across this term. It's really, it includes, as I said, said already, the social, environmental, health risk and impact during the life of the product, from the raw materials to extraction, transport, manufacturing process, distribution, warehousing, sales, marketing, and including the use of the product and ultimate disposal or recycling. I've got some pictures here to help you understand a little bit better about the two different ways of economies. Our existing economy, which is largely conventional linear economy, is on the top, and you can see the various waste streams coming off. And LCA helps you identify what those waste streams are. With a zero waste economy, you can actually see there's a cyclical nature where waste gets reused or recycled and also reduced. There's an interesting quote. One half to three quarters of annual resources that come out of the ground or from plants to industry are returned to the environment as waste within a year. Now, those resources could be available to the people. They could be creating jobs, and that's an important point to understand. Zero waste actually creates jobs, and it's well known where it's been implemented. Supporting legislation for LCAs, creating awareness on these environmental and social externalities results in the cradle-to-cradle approach, which is the key component of zero waste. And extensive representation from civil society to have full cost accounting and LCAs included in the National Framework for Sustainable Development were made, but they were by and large ignored. Similar representations for full cost accounting and full life cycle assistance included in this framework bill has led to LCAs being included in Section 18 as an exemption only to specific products at the minister's discretion. But without legislation to mandate LCAs, we will never achieve the goal of a zero waste economy, at least I don't think it's possible from an industrial engineering point of view, by 2022 as per the Public Finance Declaration of 2001, which was made by government, industry and civil society. So the waste legislation gap, that's what I just wanted to highlight in this presentation, is the marginalization of LCA creates a vacuum of awareness. We aren't aware of what waste is and what its impact on our society is. And it allows these externalities and especially major toxic waste streams such as endocrine disrupting chemicals to go unnoticed and unchecked and unabated. There's no legislation to deal with these chemicals. What are endocrine disrupting chemicals? These are chemicals or mixtures from outside the body that can interfere with the development and functioning of body systems in humans, wildlife, especially the offspring. You see it has major effects on young children or the development of the fetus in the womb, and they have irreversible adverse health effects. This definition was taken from a report which was circulated to all the major ministries in 2005, including the presidency, largely ignored. It was almost as if government decided to take the ostrich approach to this and bury its head in the sand. During the last century, over 70,000 new man-made chemicals were synthesized for product manufacture. This was from the report. Over 1,500 new chemicals are introduced each year. And very little health data is actually there for these chemicals. And recent signs of endocrine disruption, which really only started to come about in the early 90s, has revealed that these chemicals and their metabolites are usually persistent. Some more persistent than others. The more persistent ones we see, so that's the POPs and the Stockholm Convention, but there are other persistent chemicals out there, many of them. And they bioaccumulate in the food chain and they affect our delicate hormone system. So what do they do? At extremely low doses, 25 Olympic swimming pools, if you had that much water and you put one drop into that much water of one of these chemicals, you would have a toxic dose which could give you cancer, immune system suppression, birth defects, effects on sexuality, cognitive and physical development, especially children and as I said, the fetus development and during critical periods of fetal development, especially, and numerous other diseases such as asthma and endometriosis. These are some of the sources. I'm not going to go into them in detail. They're there in the handout. If anybody hasn't got one, I've got one for you. But they're pretty much all around. They're ubiquitous. We can't escape exposure. In fact, nobody has escaped exposure since 1950 to these chemicals. Even those people who live in remote rainforests in Central America, where they, through modeling, have determined that there's very, very little influence from chemicals. So this is something which I find quite interesting and shocking. Does anyone here have a guess as to what this is? I know there's some environmentalists here and some experts in chemicals. You can see there's some really nasties in this soup of chemicals. Does anyone want to guess what this is? Ladies and gentlemen, this is an honourable member and chair. This is mother's milk, typical mother's milk sample. You can see some really nasty industrial chemicals have contaminated the very milk that we feed our children. And these high concentrations, this really high body burden, that they call it the toxic payload. The first child gets a huge dose of it, the second child gets less, and the third child will get less as these chemicals come out of the mother's fat into the milk. And they create a lot of diseases, including immune system, depression, and cancer. Now, I think it's a very important point to raise with the present AIDS epidemic that some of these chemicals are linked to immune system depression. And another thing is the cancer epidemic in the country. There's not much focus on it, but we're very close to the American standard of 1 in 3 women contracting cancer in their lifetime and 1 in 2 men contracting cancer in their lifetime. Our statistics are very, very close to that. So even if you look at the economic benefits of reducing these chemicals, they're huge benefits. There's job creation in research for safe alternatives. There's creation of new jobs in the manufacturing sector to produce these new products and materials, especially for export. There's reduction of foreign expenditure. There's a lot of them, including, I mean, there's some quite interesting benefits, like those related to at the bottom, the increase in society's average IQ as a result of much disrupting the cognitive development of our children. Now, I could talk about zero waste economic benefits and job creation, and a lot of them, if you look at zero waste as opposed to landfills and incineration, but that's already well documented. So what I will rather talk about is something that isn't really that well documented and focused on, is that the agricultural waste, and I would like to thank Comrade Buthelezi for bringing this to the attention of everyone here. But really what we have is conventional agriculture is dependent on fossil fuel, fertilizer, pesticide, fungicide, and herbicide. And all of these inputs have externalities. And the major externalities are pesticide waste or that pesticide usage is a waste. Excuse me, I'm trying to go very quickly here. Which is a pollution that will pollute our atmosphere, our water courses, and our food. And it's a scarce legislation. And this is, and I can say this with quite clear conscience that it is a scarce legislation in this country, because the ASP, which is the African Stockwork Program, had an expert from the United Nations to come in and assess our pesticide management legislation. And it was very clear that our pesticide management legislation stops as soon as the farmer sprays whatever it is that he's spraying. Then it's the pesticide magically disappears and it's no longer an issue anymore. Which we know actually is not true. There's a lot of documented cases. I'm not going to go through, but Dr. Leslie London of the University of Cape Town, basically, he sums it up and he says, and he's done a lot of studies into pesticide contamination and of society, and especially rural workers and water courses in our countryside. And he said, I think there's a view that if you live in the country, you should accept this pollution as a way of life. And pesticide waste and water pollution, most of the towns from Dr. Leslie's study in the Western Cape have their groundwater contaminated, and many towns have their drinking water contaminated with unsafe levels of pesticides. Similar studies in the Eastern Cape also reveal the same thing. And the problem isn't just related to pesticides, but to industrial chemicals. A recent study of city water in Pretoria shows that it's contaminated with above safe levels of sulfate. Endoconductive chemicals are entering their waste stream, which is not being managed at all, and it's because there's no life cycle assessment. And one of the things is that even in government programs like the ESA program, when without life cycle assessment, the ESA program cannot be informed properly. So one of the programs in the area where I come from in the Eastern Cape is the planned Eastern Cape biofuel program. It's 500,000 hectares of prime traditional communal land and common uses, which will be blockbusted into canola, soya, and maize monocropping. Not say blockbusted, they take the traditional land. In fact, I've got a picture here for those members of the House who don't understand what this is like. This is what the
front guy will look like in 5 or 6 years' time. Bottom thousand for the most part, and this is prime minister that gets the most rainfall throughout the year, has the best soil conditions, and has the slope less than 8 degrees. You can see there's no sign of people here. I don't know what happened to all the houses and the Nick Bomo and but it's a very far cry from the image that you see in the country that we walked past on the way to this room. And in fact, if an image is held together through the use of massive use of pesticides, particularly around the pesticide, which is going to be used on the GMS, which they decided they're going to go with this program. And the GMS is resistant to the pesticide, so it can be used to get rid of weeds. Now, the only predictor is income in common grant. This is already gazetted, this program is gazetted. If anyone doesn't believe me, he has a premier speech at the beginning of this year which highlights this program. The LTAs of Roundup herbicide, I'm just going to do a little bit, because if LTAs were done, this program would never have got off the ground. Because Roundup contains toxic, endocrine disrupting glyphosate and surfactants, Roundup herbicide destroys soil life, it persists in the soil for up to 2 years, the Roundup contaminates workforces. Already in France, the people have won a victory against Monsanto, the company that produces Roundup, because we told them it was all safe, and actually it's contaminated the water, and they actually pay in the liability to the farmers in France. Roundup is systemically absorbed into fruits and grains. No amount of washing and cooking can eliminate the toxic Roundup ingredients once they've contaminated the food, and this is from the World Health Organization report. So it's well-known information, but yet, without the LTA, we can't unpack this issue. And empty Roundup containers are even used for water storage by rural communities. So that's the one option for agricultural development. But if you take the zero-waste alternative, a zero-waste is really about thinking out of the box. And thinking out of the box leads to a completely different way of farming, where you use nature, plants, animals, like conventional farming, but you also use bacteria and fungi and algae. And you make a profit from the waste stream of each process. I just put very quickly this is a very simple zero waste farming method which can be practiced on any small holding. And it typically involves a digester and a breakdown of food waste. And if anyone wants to go into detail, I can go into detail from that. But you can see the dollar sign represents the various profit streams that come out of it. It's a completely different farming to monoculture. And it's very compatible with traditional farming systems. In fact, you need animals to run it. Here's a small example, and I don't have much time, so I'm going to fly through this, but it's practiced around the world. There's digesters on the, I think if you can see my mouth, my cursor moving, and those are digesters under the ground, that's a testing pond, those are algae ponds there. That's the pond there where there's fish growing in there, and these are actually vegetables growing on the effluent. And this is a more of a polishing pond here. And these are cassava and pawpaws growing there. You can see that's what it looks like. Vegetables growing actually on the liquid fertilizer that produce food, fuel, fertilizer, and animal feed. The algae is a very good animal feed, you know, feed for biofuel. But the fertilizer is very interesting. It actually beats conventional fertilizer in the studies that were done. Because what happens with the digester, ordinary nitrite, get converted to nitrates, and the same thing with phosphates and the potassium. So you don't lose nutrients. The composting will lose up to 50% of the nutrients. But with this you don't. It's very compatible. In the eastern case of Burundi, just a Kaya Makati. She's got a farm with cattle and pigs, and he's using it. He built a very cheap digester to kick off, and his algae ponds are working now as well. He's making a lot of very high protein, high nutrient rich animal feed for the food.
The biogas digester is a 3,000-year-old technology. There's 50 million biogas digesters on the planet, most of them in India and in China. There are over 5 million electric fuel vehicles in the world that can run on biogas. That means you can run your car on the fuel. In Germany, they make electricity out of it. In the US, they make electricity out of it. In Sweden, there's 800 biogas buses and more than 4,500 cars that run on either petrol or biogas. Here's a very cheap one, like the one that we're putting in the Eastern Cape at the moment. This is a more complex one, which is one in Stellenbosch. So there are some already in South Africa. This is the one that I commissioned in Stellenbosch. I just bear with me while I'm throwing my video on. That methane burning was actually the methane that was produced by me, my wife, and my two children, and our food waste. We didn't even have animals. If we had informal, we could produce maybe, if we had seven cars, we could produce about 11,000 rand worth of LPG gas in 1 year. It's free energy. I've seen programs or presentations where guys come from industry and say, this is the smallest fired biofuel plant. This is the smallest fired biofuel plant. That's it. It's very small, and it runs with bacteria, low technology. They never go on strike. The food is and your sanitation, your everything is taken care of. It's even cheaper than putting in a septic tank, but yet somehow it's not getting rolled out. Biogas can be used for many different things. You can use it for heat and power to make electricity. What they're now doing is they're turning it into for gas to run in vehicles or to feed into a gas grid for cooking. And the latest thing now is to convert it with steam reformation, and I'm sure you heard of these hydrogen fuel cells. You can actually run a hydrogen fuel cell on methane. This is the world's first biogas train, and they've made more trains now, and they've got more cars, and they've got trucks and buses. These are all running on clean fuel. I know some of you honorable members are concerned about the toxic emissions from liquid fuel. Methane is, there's absolutely no impurities. There's no MTBE, which is the additive they put in fuel, which causes cancer and a lot of other diseases, also an endocrine disrupting chemical. There's no benzene. Benzene is also a chemical which, in fact, all of petrol contains 1% benzene, but yet, even the EPA in America acknowledges that there's no safe exposure limit to benzene. It can alter your genes. Not your device, but your actual genetic code. Very, very dangerous chemical, and yet it's coming out of all of the cars. Now, BP, for example, they had a sustainability report, and it's a very big report, and how wonderful their company is, how green it is, but yet they won't even acknowledge that there's benzene in their fuel. There's not even mention of MTBE. Now, these are toxic additives that without an LCA, we are being hoodwinked by these big corporates who won't acknowledge what they're doing. And we can free ourselves from this liquid fuel brigade. In fact, Sasol doesn't need to make liquid fuel. They can make methane from coal. The rural biogas suggests the benefits for rural society, of course, there's a lot of benefits. There's less pollution, there's safety from paraffin stoves, there's elimination of harmful diseases, you see in Delma and other places in the Kai, like typhoid, paratyphoid, cholera, dysentery. All of these things get destroyed by the retention time in the anaerobic digestion stage. Basically, a digestive is something where you don't get oxygen coming to it for at least 40 days. And of course, after the digestive, you've got no oxygen in the water. You need oxygenated. You use algae. And algae, you can actually harvest like this. This is from a typical zero waste farm. And you can actually extract the oil from this algae, this Clarella algae, but 14 to 22% oil. You can see, people are talking about biofuels. This is a chart of biofuels. You can see Clarella at the bottom there, much higher than anything else that's on the biofuel strategy at the moment. And yet, completely ignored, even though we've made extensive representations to the Department of Minerals and Energy. Algae, we need sunlight, we need nutrients, and we need carbon dioxide, and basically the biogas that is provides the carbon dioxide and the nutrients, and the we've got the best one in the world. We should be making lots of energy and feed and fuel. So this is, these are people doing it already,
and there's algae ponds, and this is where you can actually see guys growing water on the plant, plants on the water. You see the fish farming comes in because after the algae ponds you get a lot of zooplankton getting formed, and the fish eat the zooplankton after the acidification phase. It's really a completely different way of farming to what the agricultural experts will tell you is necessary for Africa. This is what a typical household will earn in Somo. I don't know if any of you know Somo, very close to where I live. There the average person, according to South Africa, is 5 cows, 6 sheep, 7 goats, and 2 pigs. This is what they can produce in 1 year if they started to just start beginning to explore zero waste farming. Obviously, there's a lot more products they can produce. This is really just the tip of the iceberg. But it's about 182,000 rand that they could earn. I've got some comparisons. I'm not going to go into detail. But basically, it aligns with it with Agisa, because we're talking about ending the dead assets of the community. That's the animals. 70% of all rural communities have got animals more than just chickens. And there's a lot of benefits. I'm talking about access to energy, sanitation, water, purity and recycling, distribution of land. We're talking about instead of having monoculture and these huge big tracts of land, dividing the land up into smaller stands. 5 hectares is all you need to make a living. But zero waste, it's got a bigger potential. Honourable members, I know this is a little bit off the topic, but I would like you to hold this vision of a dream of if we had to adopt zero waste and LCAs, we would intersect the present development focus, which takes no account of its externalities, and we would focus on these more profitable solutions, which don't benefit big business, but actually benefit the community. So there's 41 million hectares of land, which is up for redistribution. If it was broken down into 5 hectare farms, we would produce, you can see here, more than what South Africans can use in vehicle fuel. And we'll capacitate 8 million families with land stewardship. We'll create 16 million jobs in zero waste agriculture, in cooperative-based zero waste farming community. We'll have, obviously, that link to a distribution system. We need to get that food, that diverse food, to the market, to the customers directly, bypassing these guys like ShopRite, which are not bought up by public equity. And have been exploiting the consumers, and obviously the big corporates have been exploiting us, but we've seen how the Competition Authority gave a 90 million rand fine, just a slap on the wrist to some of these big guys for price fixing.
Water security, basically,
I'm almost finished. Count your 41 rand, it would come that soon. Zero waste organic food revolution, basically, organic farming is big. I'm not going to go into the detail, but it's got a lot of benefits, and I've listed them all here with references, and you can see to them. But one of the biggest thing, I mean, there's a lot of different things here. They've proven now recently that it's got more antioxidants and all sorts of things. But anyway, I'm going to go straight to this FAO report for May 2007, where the top agricultural experts around the world have agreed that if South Africa went, or Southern Africa went 50% organic, they would achieve food security. And this is completely contrary to what the experts who come from the schooling of that are sponsored by the big agrochemical companies, the institutions that are promoting these experts and officials. They're basically saying we can't do this. But the real experts are saying we can. They're basing on a lot of studies. This is a very good study if you've got time to read it. Basically, they said in developed countries, 2 to 3 times more per hectare than conventional food, and in underdeveloped countries, 10 times more per hectare. So this is a quote by the professor who was studying this, and they were amazed. The corporate interest in agriculture has really influenced the government policies. And I think it's time that we need to unpack these things. And with the LCA tool, this just won't happen. It's possible. Cuba achieved 80% of food production, and they did this in organic in less than 10 years. And it's a community-based solution when you look at it, zero waste agriculture. And I'm just going to charge you to really consider the impact of leaving LCA out of a framework. This is agriculture that's exported. Imagine if we had to put it into industry as well, where all products we understand as a consumer exactly what the environmental and social and health impacts of buying a product is, even if it's a newspaper, we can understand what the damage that ink is doing to our children. I think it would be very important information, and it relates to a constitutional right to access to information. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are you Mr. Wilk or are you Dr.
Wilk? Yeah, no, this is Mr. Wilk.
So, once in the time you get someone who makes your time, it's the kind of thing that you can want to hear. It's the thing that you're looking for. It should come from us. Yeah, we certainly appreciate you from the point of view of the AOC, Mr. Monte. We will take this to follow one. Any comments or questions? Yaman, Randa, and Makara.
Sure, thank you very much. Sure, that we learned that, I mean, I'm interested in this case because it is a well-known fact that people using this gas containers and then gas inside their houses have had sometimes had their homes destroyed by gas. It is sometimes when the children are at home alone, they switch on the stove, and in case you are not aware and you are not at home, someone comes into your house with a cigarette. And then the thing is, so, but how safe is yours, the guests you're speaking about? Because there are shacks, even around here, that were destroyed by guests. And is it because you want this gas for rural people only? Because we need electricity in rural areas. Yes, if you know that you've got no children in your house, you've got no smokers will come into your house, you've got some sign there that says no smokers allowed. But when it comes to us Africans, we don't do such things. We don't prevent people from coming into our houses. Everybody is welcome to visit us. But when it comes to guests, it has never been safe chatterton. I know Judea like saying that we must use gas in the rural areas. Why should people in rural areas be the people who are using gas? At least in towns then, they are clever, they are more clever, they know how to handle it. But what about rural areas? We need clean electricity in rural areas. But I want to know how safe is that gas you are talking about. Now that at least you say, you want people to use gas because you use it, but I doubt if you use gas. I really doubt. You have electricity, you may be using gas as just an alternative, but I doubt if you are just using gas more.
Okay, it's a very robust commission. I hope you can ask for
a comment. I've just listened to the presenters. They're inviting the portfolio committee at a certain stage to go and visit themselves. I remember it was 2004, if I'm not mistaken, when the portfolio committee visited themselves and it went around all the, you know, the hazardous areas. For instance, the engine refinery, benzene, you name them. And we ended up addressing the community. I've never seen the last of it in my life. We nearly died. They nearly just sank on us. They were deported. They say the people are dead. elsewhere does it. Same. It's an old story. Of Peter. You know, if you keep on listening to this story, it worries you. But now, you have a question. What best that can be done? At least to lessen the strength of the moisture, the chemicals around them. Going back, they are communicating around morning. And into the finery. There is a school, a big school, you know, very near Mondi. And you can imagine what happened, because you just, by passing that area, you just feel that I cannot be careful in our thing. The smell is so strong and killing effect. But what I'm saying, I have no, you know, what best can be done just to lessen this. And I was listening to Mr. Dikar. He just made mention of better technology. Maybe he can expand a little bit about things. Because I remember the other day when I made mention of things, GDG said, no. It doesn't help, you know. But she said she would help us, because you still make mention of technology which might be utilized to lessen whatever. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Yeah, I have heard Mark's presentation before and it's impressed me a great deal. In fact, I came back and I told the chair about it, but obviously I didn't do it with enough passion, and now that he has seen the real thing, he is more captivated by the whole concept. But I just wondered if its application, it has only really been tried with small farmers, and maybe that's great, because that is the way where it is most usual and where it is most possible. Is there any way to enable it to be used on a wider scale? And also, I imagine the fact that nobody's going to make a lot of profit out of it except for the person who uses it. Know what the blockages have been as far as making it more widely used, more intellectually and mentally acceptable to the government, because they just doesn't seem to have gone really from A to B in terms of policy as far as mineral and energy particularly is concerned. Why is it not happening?
Thanks, Jim. Thank you for the presentation. With regards to LCA, Mr. Wells, is it your view that you would like to see LCA as a mandatory way of analysis of waste in the village stand? I mean, at the moment, it's at the discretion of the minister, from my reading of it. Based on that, and considering that the reality is that this bill, once passed in whatever form, will probably take, well, certainly around more than 5 years to probably implement every single component of it from an implementation perspective, and the regulations which are going to be made for specific sectors. And following on from the comments of Chalmers, what is your assessment of the ability of different sectors in an economy to be able to implement LCA in a short time frame? Because I agree that it is something that we're going to have to bring about. My question is really, how quickly can it be done? And related to that, then, is there not then merit in the minister having discretionary powers in order to respond to specific sectors? Because if we agree that ultimately everyone has to do it, I think I would like to see if the minister was, if we were to grant it in the way that it is, and the minister was to drag his or her feet on particular sectors, we could certainly follow it up. But I get the sense that it is going to, and perhaps you wouldn't be sympathetic to this view, quite implementable in some sectors and less so in others, but I guess we'll have to agree that ultimately everyone needs to implement. So your comments essentially on the discretion versus the mandatory nature of it.
If we're to move towards the form of accounting
industry,
how much it costs us? And would a good cost not for PD, such as the private sector people will have to take cash? To conceptualize this issue of the insurer. So for me, I must admit this, maybe it was an issue. That, for me, by insurers, I know the concerns about human beings cannot be separate.
Christian group. But if they, if you look at the level of poverty, it's an accomplishment. You know, you cannot create an intervention that may have an impact on that, poverty. So is it not possible for them to conceptualize in what you were discussing in the thing that study group Jakuba under the alternative plans that could be considered there? And could not imagine that being integrated not in this way that people are going to produce countrywide, but integrated with the village youth and all of that. Is that completely undefined situation where you can record if this intervention can take you out of format, we must treat it with all circumstances of the shared format. And there's not the wrong only the limited standard and gene outside of that matrix. So is there no way of imagining this? So only one gap. So I'll not begin.
Thank you, Honorable Chief. Yeah, I think the first question is the I think the communities that have moved out of the townships in Umlazi and Lamontville, moving on to the block and using their life savings to build better houses, and welcome the visit of the portfolio committee. Because one of the things they say, we thought Barelo Tebengu also like Shoshana Namatang Bado Bado Puma. I think it's important that that the portfolio committee visits, because the communities were not aware of the dangers that lurk at the island view complex, and when the tanks blew up, they were not aware where to go to. And up until today, no government official has gone there. Yep. Even the local municipality, including the provincial premier, I have raised it at a meeting with them. There's been no evacuation procedures or emergency plans. More importantly, when we had the fire on Monday, the same thing happened. No evacuation and procedures in place. So our people that live in the township that have moved on to the south and went to welcome them. But let me say also, in engaging JEET at the national level, the standards that have been proposed are so weak, it will never bring about change. It's even worse than the permit system that's been allowed presently in Durban. So we need strong legislation to bring about change. If you think back since 2004, with the ACRC Act, there's been very little change. We've had more fires and explosions since then than anything else. And remember, South Durban is a very vocal community. What about communities in Richards Bay and other communities? So we need strong standards. This portfolio committee must really urge the department to start thinking about change. And thinking about change cannot come about through policy means. The industry has been operating for over 50 years. How is it that they've not learned? These companies operate differently in Europe. They treat our lives in Africa as cheap, and therefore continue to dump their toxic chemicals because they know at the end of the day the profit is going to New York and to London. And we are suffering the health impact in South Africa. So imagine the portfolio committee to really urge the department while they are here that we need strong standards and we need it today, not tomorrow. The other very crucial point that I want to make to the department is that there is going to be a public meeting on the 29th in Durban around the engine issue, and I would urge the department to visit the community and call me, and we would invite you with a lot of security this time to make sure the only problem with a year is the people that went to the hospitals and to the clinics to get the medical treatment. That's where you're going to hear how much of people were affected, how much of waste was dumped in. We need to ask the department of why the year. Why is the Green Corps rushing together? They're right wherever they are, from Al Malun and you know, the western cape of the fishermen. Surely they should be rushing to Durban with engine now. An engine has been fined R10,000 by the local municipality about a year, 2 years ago. They should be rushing now to arrest them. Thank you.
Regarding gas safety, and I must stress that it's nothing like what happens in engine. You saw that digester that was flaring. That was flaring directly out of the digester was built underneath. There was just one pipe. It cannot explode because there's no oxygen in it. And I've never heard of a digester exploding yet. It's low pressure that the gas is held in, and very little quantities of it at a time. So it's actually a very safe gas, and I mean we've got, as I said, 15 million digesters around the world, and it's considered very safe for rural communities as well as urban communities. It's not just a rural only thing. There are many urban communities that are producing biogas in Sweden. They're using biogas from co-digestion. We talk about waste management. It's a waste management program. They take their solid waste, their bio waste, food waste, restaurant waste, all of that stuff, and they co-digest it with their sewage waste. Sometimes they even put a little instinct, a thrasher thing that you put your food in, it chops it up, it goes down. They don't even have the problem of collecting waste, you know, wet waste, biodegradable waste, which can only smell and causes disease and can get flies and rats and things like that. So you don't, with the digital technology, you can avoid all of that. And the other thing is that, unlike a septic tank or a fish latrine or a conservancy tank, which you have to get the guys to come and empty, there you don't have the smell with the digester. Because it's an anaerobic process, there's no air can get into it, no air can get out of it. You don't smell the stuff. The liquid that comes out of it doesn't have the smell. That is why in Lesotho, the people have got more digesters in Lesotho than we have in South Africa. And the reason why is because the people in the mountains, they didn't want to get those big trucks to come and pump out their tanks because it cost them R3,000 for one trip. So they said, no, we want a better technology, and they got digester technology there. But in Constantia, the people, Raymond Ackerman's family, very, very rich family, they want digester technology because they think it's hip, it's not infantry. I know other people in very exclusive suburbs who are calling out for digester technology, and they've been installed. It's something which gives you a very good feeling. When you go to the toilet and you know that you're not wasting anything, in fact, you're going to gain. You're not losing. there's other things. What else do I want to say? Like Mr. McCarthy. He's got about 10 cars going through, but he's really only feeling his pig waste at the moment because his digestion is a little bit too small because he didn't have any money. He lived hand to mouth, put in that digestion. He needed a little bit bigger one, but you know, we just wanted to get something going, you know. The digestive car has cost less than R3,000 to install the digestion and less than R3,000 to actually put the algae plants in. So it's something which is very low cost solution. In fact, it was cheaper than that because we put it into our cooperative, the cooperative of 12 farmers in our area who are committed to zero waste farming, and they're all helping each other to try and get off the ground. We don't have any other help anywhere else. But Mr. McCarthy, for example, I wanted to tell you what he does. Every day he's cooking his putu pap and his sampan beans. Because he's got a big family and he's got lots of guys who help him on the farm, and his children every morning they heat their water up before they go to school, so they wash with that. It's a huge benefit. You must remember a lot of rural communities they have to go and collect firewood. It affects women. They've got to spend many hours, sometimes 3 hours a day collecting firewood. You know, that's a big problem, and we're running out of forest. The other thing is talking about safety. Most people are still using paraffin stoves, and you know what that is. There's inhalation, there's all of that, but also shack fires from paraffin. You don't get that with gas. It's a control thing. You open the tap, you
light your gas, you close it. And you know, with this gas, it's not like the high pressure LPG gas you buy from the shop. That's dangerous. Yes, I completely agree with you. With biogas, it's cleaner. There's no toxic components or bits that you get like you get in LPG, liquid petroleum gas. It's a much cleaner and also renewable energy. That LPG gas is not renewable, so that LPG gas will be fine again. I just got some other things. The application. Yeah, we got some other comments from the honourable members, which was around about the size of it. Yes, it can go too large. The biggest suggestions the biggest ones that I know of in Brazil, they serve communities of, I think, 25,000 people at a time. That's the biggest suggestion that you can build them yourselves, and then you can just add them on modularly. So you can have them as a sanitation solution. Now, Rhodes University in Grahamstown in South Africa, they spent 15 years researching biogas and algae technology. They are at the forefront of that technology. The Department of Water Affairs commissioned them to prove that biogas digesters work and that the algae technology works so well that the effluent from that can go straight into the aquifer and meets the draft standards. And they proved this, and they proved it for a number of byways, including tanneries and all of those kind of byways. But yet, it's not been rolled out. And one of the reasons they're finding is that the civil engineers who quote them, let's say a community needs a sanitation solution, they get a civil engineering company to come, they design it, and because they design it, they also commission it, and because they commission it, they get the commission, that 15% engineering fee. And the bigger the project, the more expensive and more elaborate, the better. And also, if you're using chemicals, those guys are all in with the chemical supplying companies, the guys supplying the chlorine and whatever else for the packing houses. There's a very tight-knit engineering fraternity linked to the suppliers and everybody, and it's very difficult to break that. That's one of the institutional blockages. The other institutional blockage to this is, especially in the rural side, and you look at the picture of the Eastern Cape Biofuel Strategy, that's a strategy performed, put together by the Eastern Cape Biofuel Charge Team. The Biofuel Charge Team was established written by the Eastern Cape, ECGC. And they basically, they wanted to attract investors to the East London IDZ and the Cooper IDZ. And they attracted the likes of a German company, I don't know if you heard of them, ThyssenKrupp, the same guys who were involved in the farm deal. They said, no, we can put a biofuel plant here, but we need a feedstock. What are you going to give us? So they went out and they decided, they said, can we give them a, what are we going to give them, an oil or ethanol, which one is going to be? And they did some trials and they said canola, because the Germans wanted canola ready, because canola doesn't have a problem at low temperatures. It doesn't freeze like some of the other biodiesel. So what happened is they said, no, we can do canola. So they trialed the canola, they finally could grow, and now they're propagating it out. And it's ready so that we can take that extension of the master food production program and add a biofuel component. We know that the master food production failed already. It was 350 million rand was spent on the program that hasn't really produced anything. And now they're putting more money into this, and it's all for a German company to make profits, and all of the oil that's going to come from it is going to go to the EU. So I think it's quite interesting for you guys to think about that. That's another blockage. The other blockages, you know, the DFC has got it on their desk. The biogas implementation program for South Africa, which was commissioned by one of the top renewable energy companies, Agama Energy, they commissioned them to do the study to see how feasible it was. And the study showed quite clearly it's very feasible and a lot of people will benefit. But it's still sitting on the desk and nothing's happened for 2 years. Okay, and then I've got another question, sorry, I'm going through these, around LCAs and mandatory analysis. Basically, what is this, you know, the LCAs, they're already standards. The ISO 14014 is a standard which exists for LCAs. Now, I know that South African companies very quickly jumped to ISO 9000 when the EU said, look, you can't import goods unless you go ISO 9000. And then now they jump to ISO 14000. And it's just another step, ISO 14014. for them, they can do it in 5 years. Those companies that have ICO for 14,000 and 14,000 already can do it sooner. And most of the big corporates have got ICO 14,000. They've got all of the procedures in place. They can actually deliver very, very quickly on this. As an industrial engineer, I've written procedures for a number of South African companies to achieve ISO 9000, and now it's not a big alarm there at all. And who better? I mean, they know what their products are. They understand all of these things, limited disclosure, and that's what that's about. So there is no real roadblock there. I mean, the industry will say, oh, it's a big issue, but actually it's not. These standards exist, they are well documented, and then the international standards. Obviously, they haven't been very well adopted internationally because most of the big corporates that are around the world don't want to disclose what the externalities are to consumers. But you know, I think one of the things that you can do is that you can phase it in, and I think it should also be. It could be voluntary, because obviously consumers. If the product is branded, if the LCA is available, and I know if I can go to my supermarket and I can take a barcode scanner and I can scan their product and I can see what my climate change footprint is, or what my what the difference between the lowest paid worker and the highest paid worker is, and I can see these inequalities or whatever it is, I can make an informed decision if I want to buy that pair of Nikes or that pair of Adidas. Just they're right there in the shop if that information is available to me. On a barcode or to my cell phone or whatever. You know, it's actually a benefit for so many companies to start getting on the bandwagon and volunteers, especially if it becomes a co-branding exercise. What else is there? I spoke about the intrinsic aspect of buying it. And obviously a visit to see what you're doing is welcome. I also would suggest you come and see our partners at Rhodes University. They've got the Biogas and Algae Research Station there that's been going for 15 years. Very, very inviting. They actually have run out of money. Nobody's sponsoring that. And in fact, one of the sad parts of this program is we wanted to work with them to develop this rural agricultural component. But Anglo America took over that facility to do trials to see how algae can be used to clean up their toxic dump sites in the Transvaal. So Anglo-America has actually taken away our rural biogas opportunity. So we have to pioneer this ourselves, and we don't have access to the academic institution because the facilities are totally overwhelmed by Anglo's need to clean up their act. I just want to say that as I mentioned before, the conservancy tanks and the safety tanks and the fitness streams and the VIPs, they're far more inferior solutions to biogas. And with regard to poverty alleviation, you get more biofuels per hectare, to answer your question, Mr. Chair, than the other programs.
I was saying that it is difficult if one loses the combat institution to say that you can know the intervention. But only things that you can read might take those from you. I've worked out this year, but only things it looks, it's okay for me. It's not showing you the national economy. So, it's a 5 million. If people are in a group with one resource, okay, it might change the people out. It's going to be very difficult to ask whether it is not possible to look at the biofuel in the manner that they are doing about here, but in a way that it can be fit. In the manner that you're doing the limited capacity. But in the way that you're doing the limited capacity. Is that possible, or is that protocol accepted for that? The what was the difficulty was the confusion.
No, Mr. Chair, I think it's completely possible to have both systems going, and you know, it's quite interesting to compare the two when they run out purely. But you know, with the zero waste agriculture, you can take an average community where there's a crow, you can put a biogas digester there, and you can start to harvest that energy right away. That energy comes to the community within 3 weeks. They're producing gas, they're producing fertilizer, and then from that, the algae ponds produce animal feed. So Kaya Makati, for example, he used to pay a lot of money for his pig food and his chicken food. Now he just buys very cheap bran, and he supplements it with the algae, which is 58% protein. So he's getting a better nutrition, and his animals are looking much more healthy now than they were before. And he's saving money, and then he's got liquid fertilizer, which he can use for crops, like biofuels or vegetable crops or maize or canola or whatever it is. It's a liquid fertilizer which he can actually use. So it is totally compatible. I would very much caution against the use of GMOs and monoculture and pesticides. And it's very possible to grow canola and maize and many other things in an organic fashion. So it doesn't preclude the two. The two are compatible. In fact, the Organic Freedom Project has got takeoff agreements with BP for organic soya, and they presented this to the Eastern Cape Agricultural Steering Committees and people like that. But unfortunately, you know, these guys are so enamored with the big business solutions that they haven't got any capacity to support organic farming. There's no extension offices that can roll out and assist with organic farming. So the program is not going to get off the ground. All of those guys need to be trained up. Now the FAR experts say that, you know, we should be pushing it because for traditional farmers it's the best thing. For them to switch to organic, they can achieve many things. The fastest growing market, the conventional food is growing at 3%, but the organic food is growing at from about 20 to 35%, and sometimes up to 70% with some of the fair trade products. So it's one of the fastest growing markets in the world apart from the biofuels market. So and this zero waste agriculture produces biofuels and organic produce. So you know there's a lot of reasons to switch over and look at this quite seriously. Unfortunately, as I say, the expert advisors to government and to the Ministry of Agriculture, and they've been schooled in a green revolution philosophy from the institutions that are sponsored by the chemical companies. And it's a well-known fact that all of the academic agricultural colleges have programs which are streamed and to support industry. So the academic streaming is completely away from organic, and so there isn't really that capacity within government to advise them to take that direction. So it's a bit of an uphill battle. But it's very refreshing to hear such enthusiasm from the honourable members and yourself, Mr. Chairman. So I'm actually feeling quite relieved, actually. But we are doing this ourselves, Lenzela, and we're working with our own solution because we're not getting support, and this is how we start. So you guys are welcome to come and see and experience the benefits of zero waste agriculture. And my telephone number is on the presentation. If anyone doesn't have a copy of it, I've got two or three here. Well, then, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't want to invite you to the public hearing that will be happening next March, April, on renewable energy. I think your element of renewable energy will be useful mix to what you want to recover. We are quite sure.
Thank you for that. I just forgot that one of the things that's around safety, I forgot to mention that with biogas vehicles, the National Automobile Association and the standards testing for even in America have acknowledged that biomethane is a much safer fuel than petrol. So because what happens if you have an accident, that gas goes straight up into your atmosphere, it's very light. And it's not like petrol, that's just around. So even as a vehicle fuel, it's safer as well. So I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just wanted to reflect on your question that you asked about the cost of life cycle assessment, if it has to be compulsory, that already we are paying for that cost. Government is wanting to fix the cost for the amount of waste that government at local level has to cover is the amount of cost that would be equivalent, if not more than the that amount for actually distributing life cycle. And with that addition, what it simply says is that you don't even have to spend that money because companies can actually have the owners to institute life cycle analysis. So in reverse thinking, the money that we are currently government is spending and people in the public are spending for waste disposal, for subsidies or remediation of contaminated land, for public health and also for social grants as a result, particularly of health impacts to individual people, is the money that people of which, slightly more than of which, can actually be equated to the cost for life cycle assessment if it has to be compulsory. And then finally, the question that Mama raised about the disparities between the type of service, of one type of service being apparently championed for one sector of the society. If one thinks about a centralized electricity generation program, you could still have ELCO generating electricity from biogas if it has to be centralized. Even though, personally, and from where I come from, the school of thinking that zero waste advocate, I wouldn't advocate for being a centralized process. But if it has to be like that, to bridge the disparity in terms of energy service provision, then you can still centralize energy generation to buy back gas harvested and as well as the generator. Thank you.
I just want to add to what Zini was saying is that decentralized electricity generation from biogas is already done around the world. People can plug biogas into a central generator, you adjust the timing, you can make electricity. You can plug it into a diesel generator, you can use it with diesel, 70% biogas. And the latest technology is hydrogen reclamation. Hydrogen fuel cell is very efficient and it's actually probably if we can develop that technology, it would be one way for rural communities to generate their own electricity right there on the spot from biogas. Thank you for letting me
the last one,
would the biogas generated energy be able to be fitted into the country? Yeah, I can answer both of those. The LCA, I'm saying it should be mandatory. It should possibly be phased in for some of the small companies that aren't ISO 14000. That's more than two ISO 14000 and 14 compatibility, which is LPA. And then I'm also saying that I think that once you've got companies going ISO 14000 and 14 and publishing that and having that as a brand standard, I think every company will want to have their products there. Otherwise, no one will buy a product if you don't. It's like buying something with your fingers on, you don't know what you're buying. But the other thing is the question about feeding into the grid, certainly all of these modern small-scale electrical producing devices can be adjusted that
that you feed your surplus energy into the grid, you can actually sell your energy back in to the grid, and that's a common practice. Users are already doing this with biogas. One of the things that you should know is that in government search for electrical energy at the moment, they're looking everywhere, but actually in the Transkei, we did the calculations based on South Africa's assessment of animal waste and how much animal waste is there. There is enough animal waste in the Transkei to be the equivalent of one Kuiper nuclear power station's worth of electrical energy that gets converted from animal waste to biogas and into electrical energy and fed into the grid. So there's one nuclear power station sitting there unused with free fuel that's renewable and will actually not only that what the benefit to the community of having electricity, but they'll also produce animal feed, they'll produce fertilizer, and all of these cyclical benefits that come from agriculture. Thank you.